Welcome to the weekend edition of Value Side. I'm David Ravel, and this is our look back at the week just passed. What a week it was. This weekend, the nation is focused on the reverberations from the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. That decision had essentially permitted unlimited access to abortion throughout the country. And yesterday began a series of protests and riots that I expect will continue throughout the weekend. Things were much quieter on Wall Street, but no less significant. Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, marched up to Capitol Hill to give his twice-yearly report to Congress. When all was said and done, Powell seemed to be able to thread the needle, assuring traders and investors that the Fed would not hike interest rates too far and crash the markets, but that it would continue on its path of gradually tightening monetary policy and thereby control inflation. It was a real high-wire act by the chairman, and he seemed to come through with flying colors. However, even as Powell spoke, we did get a couple of indications that this economy is continuing to deteriorate. First, purchasing managers seemed to turn cautious as they recorded their weakest report in the last 5 months. And then, the report which really took the street by surprise. Consumer confidence, an essential component for retail spending, consumer confidence dropped to an all-time low. Never have consumers been this negative on our economy. This does not bode well for the balance of this year's retail sales, the most important segment of the economy. So let's sit back, grab a cup of coffee, as we review the week just passed. Inflation is arguably our number one economic problem currently. But just how bad is inflation? That's a hard question to answer. We feel all the effects of rising prices every day, when we go to the grocery store, the gas station, when we pay our bills. The cost of everything is currently rising. At times like this, it's easy to assume that this is normal, that we've had inflation before, and this is just another bout of a rather unpleasant economic condition. Psychologists tell us this happens often. They call this condition normalcy bias. And honestly, I found myself thinking that's what we're in today, is just a slightly more severe bout of recurring inflation. But I don't think so anymore, and I'd like to share with you the chart that convinced me this time is different. That where we are now is orders of magnitude beyond where we've ever been before. And the reason it's been so difficult to get our hands around this current inflation is that inflation is hard to measure. Maybe that's why we have so many different ways to measure inflation. We measure it at the consumer level, the consumer price index, at the wholesale level, the producer price index, and at the overall economic level, the GDP deflator. And on it goes. Dozens of different ways to measure the rise in overall price levels that we call inflation. So I'd like to introduce you to a measure of inflation that's fallen out of favor the past few years. This measure is actually a survey of a basket of goods and services purchased by the average urban consumer. So this is a good approximation of the cost of living for people living in our major cities. And it includes as close to everything as researchers can get. Little to nothing is left out. And altogether, it's estimated that this survey includes 88% of all Americans. So a pretty good measure of inflation, wouldn't you say? Now, in the last half century, there have been two times that this measure of inflation, called the Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers, two times that it's topped 10%. The first time that it topped 10% was at the beginning of the 1980s, when then-Fed Chairman Paul Volcker raised interest rates and stopped that spread of inflation. You and I discussed this last week. Now, the second time that inflation by this measure topped 10% was in the mania leading up to the great financial crisis of 2007 and 8. That time, a sudden and severe recession stopped inflation in its track. And in looking at this past 50-year history, it's easy to see that this particular recession was the most severe contraction of modern times. So, two major bouts of inflation in 50 years, both topping out when inflation hit roughly 10%. So where do we stand today? Answer, today's inflation is double the worst of these two other inflation storms. When last measured, at the end of March, the Urban Consumer Price Index stood at 22%, double the worst that's been before. And as you and I know, inflation has not been slowing since March. In fact, I believe it's gotten much, much worse. It's likely accelerating, climbing even higher. In short, today's inflation is like a cancer, literally eating away at the heart and soul of our economy. Now, the causes of this inflation are many and varied, and we've spent a great deal of time talking about them. An horrific energy policy that has sent the price of gasoline soaring, an ill-conceived stimulus program that doubled our money supply, natural disasters like drought and disease that are wreaking havoc on our food supply. All these and more have contributed to the situation we're in now. But unfortunately, this current administration seems ill-prepared or disinclined to fully address these issues that lie before us. As Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, said a couple of weeks ago, we need a modern-day Manhattan Project, a massive, focused program to deal with the energy and other issues like food, which are now contributing more and more to inflation. But from Washington, all I hear are crickets. Perhaps a tepid trip to Riyadh to beg for oil, or a nasty letter to our own oil companies, but I see no effective strategy that addresses our current supply issues in both food and fuel. So ahead of us lies the most probable alternative, the one that followed both the inflation of the 80s and the early 2000s, and that is a recession. A recession, I'm sorry to say, that will likely be all the more severe because of this administration's unwillingness to deal with the issues we face now. In the end, this level of inflation will break our economy. Yesterday was the longest day of the year, the day that summer begins on many calendars, and a time we celebrate the sunny days and warm weather of this particular time of the year. It'll be 6 long months before we face the year's shortest day, the time when winter will again bring its cold weather and the need for us to supply our own heat. It is, after all, in the winter when our energy needs climb. As the thermometer falls, we seek many ways to warm our homes. Most popular is natural gas, followed by electricity, heating oil, wood, and other forms of renewables. Now, the one thing we can be sure of is that this year is going to present a special challenge to heat our homes and offices. The price of all the conventional forms of energy have risen spectacularly, and there is absolutely no indication that it's going to subside anytime soon. But even if we were to see everything stay just about where it is now, still, next winter's heating bill would likely be twice last year's. Frankly, we're in a terrible predicament, much of it because of the awful mismanagement of the Biden administration. But setting that discussion aside for the moment, the larger question is, how will we prepare for this coming winter, knowing that energy prices will indeed be extreme? This week, we've had a prime example of how a nation can face difficult times ahead by anticipating a crisis and then setting in motion some possible solutions. This week, the German government of Chancellor Olaf Scholz announced that they will be refiring many of their coal-powered electric plants to help bridge the gap in energy created by the Russian oil embargo. To give some background, Germany has been one of the European leaders in moving away from coal and towards more clean-burning natural gas to supply their energy. This has been a generation-long effort by the Germans to become more environmentally friendly. But with the outbreak of the Ukraine war and the Western powers' boycott of Russian oil and gas, Germany lost its principal supplier of natural gas. So Scholz and the German government took the only responsible step. They went back to coal-powered electric. It has to be a tremendous turnabout, a complete change in the direction of German energy policy. And yet they literally had no choice. Germany was staring right in the face of a very, quote, cold, dark winter, to use the recurring meme of our own president. Now, to his credit, Olaf Scholz was able to see the future, that cold, dark winter, and plan to overcome its impact. Planning for the future can overcome much of life's worst events. And in this case, I believe the Germans are on the right path to survive what could potentially have been a very, very deadly winter. Now, for all of the NATO countries, the timing of the Russian oil blockade has up to now been quite fortunate. President Biden announced that the U.S. would sanction, quote-unquote, all Russian oil and gas on March the 9th. And as a practical matter, the sanctions didn't actually go into effect for several more weeks. And by that time, we were well into spring. Now it's midsummer, so we haven't yet felt the full bite of the loss of the Russian supplies. But they are coming, and as a country, we're going to have to prepare. Incidentally, for those of you who were wondering, Biden's release of oil from our strategic reserve is set to end in late fall. So assuming he stays to that plan, there will be no help this winter from the strategic reserves. As far as I can tell, there have been absolutely no plans for supplemental energy supplies this winter. Here is a president and an administration that seems to always tell the American people, you're on your own. Look at how many times we're running into shortages of various kinds, from grocery and particularly baby formula shortage, to diesel shortage, to semiconductor shortage and medical supplies. The list is becoming endless. Each time the president tells us that they're working on the problem, but in the end, the reality is we're on our own. Is there any doubt in your mind that this winter, when the thermometer drops and the price of energy skyrockets, we will once again hear President Biden tell us, you're on your own? Oh, hell. We're living in a bizarre world, where our political leaders endlessly discuss inflation, yet most often exclude economic reality. Yesterday, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, took center stage before the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Development. The testimony is part of the Senate's oversight of the Federal Reserve, and each meeting is scheduled literally months in advance. So the first thing we should disabuse ourselves of is that this is a meeting that was somehow the Senate's response to the current economic crisis. Not so. Powell's testimony was simply a bureaucratic meeting between those bureaucrats who sit at the top of the legislative branch and those bureaucrats who preside over the central bank. Now, I'm not making this distinction to be snide. Far from it. We do need a public debate about just what's happening in our economy. But it's essential, and I think vital, that we invite the proper participants for that debate. So who is Jerome Powell, and what role does he play in the economy? He is, I have no doubt, an eminently qualified banker. He has worked in the field for many years and is highly educated. So what do bankers do? Bankers provide the financing for business, entrepreneurs, and individuals to function in our financial system. Most businesses, for instance, will go to a banker to provide funds to build and operate the business. Individuals may turn to their bank to make a significant purchase on credit, and so on. To put it succinctly, bankers, Mr. Powell included, help enhance the demand side of our economy. They help businesses to invest and individuals to make purchases. As the chief banker of the country, Powell and the Federal Reserve are perhaps the best control of the demand side of the economy. The Fed's interest rate policy promotes demand by lowering interest rates, and it inhibits demand by raising interest rates. But here's the problem. Almost none of our current inflation comes from excess demand. They all come from the other side of the economic equation, from supply. Today we have high gas prices because we don't have enough supply. Truck drivers in Maryland this past weekend ran out of fuel because the gas stations were empty. High food prices are hitting partly because of those high gas prices and also because of crop and livestock shortage. There are also shortages in baby formula, feminine supplies, and even my favorite hot sauce. All are in short supply. Now, does the chairman of the Federal Reserve have any answer for these supply-side issues? Of course not. That's not his job. And we shouldn't expect to get any answers from Powell concerning the supply side of the economy. And neither should the U.S. Senate or House of Representatives, where Powell testifies today. They should not expect any answers from the Fed on the supply side of the economy. Instead, if the House and Senate are generally concerned about the supply side of the economy, they should begin talking to those who provide the supply side answers. Those are the farmers, the grocers, and most especially the oil company executives who are at the epicenter of the current economic crisis. And I think it would be especially worthwhile to invite Mike Wirth, the CEO of Chevron Oil, to participate in any debate. It was Wirth who circulated the letter in response to President Biden's letter earlier this week. And it was Wirth who squarely put the current energy shortage on the shoulders of the president. Today, there's a massive disconnect between the people who make and provide and those who regulate. We need a public debate between those responsible for delivering the goods and products we rely upon and the bureaucrats in Washington. And it doesn't help when our regulators only talk to their peers across the street, when the Senate and House think that only the central bank can get us out of this inflation problem, they make a huge mistake. The shortages are a problem that only the private sector, the working men and women of this country, can solve. Nearly a half century ago, Ronald Reagan gave us the simple aphorism to describe the kind of economy we face today. Like those faraway 1980s, the economy back then was failing. We had gone through the supply-side shock of an oil embargo, inflation was at the highest it had been in a generation, and the country was governed by an unpopular president who couldn't seem to get anything right. Then-President Jimmy Carter's only solution to soaring energy costs was to drive slower and bundle up with a sweater. In his campaign for president, Reagan introduced this simple yet descriptive concept of a recession. Unfortunately, we're beginning to see our neighbors again losing their jobs because of a weak economy slipping into a recession. Since the pandemic of 2020, most economists have focused exclusively on job openings, the number of available jobs that can't seem to find anyone to fill them. Recently, several CEOs have complained that they can't seem to fill positions and corporate performance has suffered as a result. Walmart and Amazon, two of the country's largest employers, have been very aggressive in recruiting new workers. But now, there seems to be a new counter-trend at work, workers losing their jobs. Now, there are several reasons for this. First and foremost, Walmart and Amazon are looking for workers with lower skill levels. At the same time, those who are losing their jobs are highly skilled, highly educated workers. Now, there are a couple of factors to consider, including geography and demographics. But there's another answer to this puzzle. These lost jobs are mainly in technology and finance, two of the leading edges of the economy. Job losses in these sectors show that future economic growth is at risk. Now, tech has always been a high-risk field. Risk for the venture capitalists and the entrepreneurs who finance and manage these companies, but also risk for those people who go to work for them. Now, these enterprises can be wildly rewarding financially if they're successful, but there are many failures even in the best of times. The trouble for tech currently is that the cost of capital is rising. Those higher interest rates are the cause, and so investors often don't have the reserves to continue with unprofitable ventures. In the last 2 years, layoffs.fyi reports that over 800 tech firms, principally startups, have all laid off more than 130,000 workers. And it's much the same story for real estate. Here, too, the cost of capital, mainly in the form of mortgages, is rising rapidly, often pricing monthly mortgage payments out of people's reach. Earlier this week, J.P. Morgan Chase, the nation's largest bank, ultimately set Wall Street back on its heels when they reported laying off 1,000 workers in their home mortgage division. The bank hopes to place up to half of those workers in other divisions, but there are no guarantees. This move followed Wells Fargo, which has also been on a layoff tear, as that bank faces a general reorganization. Of course, the current interest rate is much of the issue with home mortgages. 30-year fixed mortgages currently stand at a whisker under 6%. That's double the rate of just a year ago. So there you have it, finance and real estate, two leading-edge sectors of the economy in trouble. And both suffer from that higher cost of capital, those interest rates. And both are seeing significant layoffs. Oh, and let me complete that Ronald Reagan quote. A recession is when your neighbor loses his job. A depression is when you lose yours. And recovery is when Jimmy Carter, or dare I say Joe Biden, loses his. And that's The Value Side for the weekend of June 25 and 6. For all of our podcasts and blog posts, visit valueside.com. I'm David Rebell. ValueSide is independently written and researched. The views expressed are strictly my own.